But it's great. So thank you for that.
That's how they get you.
That's true. Scott Bryan, thank you.
Cheers, Scott. Love
Have
you to
bits. Evening.
Thank you, Scott Bryan. Brilliant. Right, the must-watch podcast is out. So we were going to do Agatha all along. So if you want to see what the team make of that, have a listen to the podcast. Holly, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
See you tomorrow. See you everyone tomorrow at 4. Monday Night Club on the way.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. This is Tom Dewsbury. Rachel Reeves has used her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to rule out a return to austerity. Addressing delegates in Liverpool, she said tough decisions were needed to deal with what she called the economic legacy left by the Conservative government. But she struck a note of optimism too as she set out her vision for the economy. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth, who's in Liverpool, was listening.
The difference is that I think the government are trying to do more explaining to people as to why they are doing what they're doing. So Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, was talking about the prize at the end of the pain, if you like. Her argument being that if the economy is stable and then you can get economic growth and you can invest in public services and everyone else feels better off.
Nurses in England have rejected the government's award of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said two-thirds of the members who voted turned down the deal, with turnout at a record high. The RCN's General Secretary, Nicola Ranger, said members were clear that the award wasn't enough to attract more nurses and keep current staff in their posts.
There's absolutely no way that we can say that nursing isn't in a crisis in this country. We are totally reliant on international nurses, and the number of people going into nursing has reduced by 27%. So this is a crisis that needs proper structural change to ensure that, you know, we keep the NHS where all of us want it to be.
The luxury department store Harrods says it's launched an internal review looking at whether current staff were involved in any of the allegations relating to Mohammed Al-Fayed. A former employee told BBC News a manager failed to investigate after she made allegations of inappropriate behaviour by Mr. Al-Fayed. The BBC understands that manager still works at Harrods. Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes against Hezbollah have killed more than 270 people and injured 1,000 more. It's been the deadliest day of fighting across the border since 2006. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
Israel has expanded its airstrikes on Hezbollah to include those places where it says it's hiding some of its most powerful long-range missiles, including in private houses. In this way, it's trying to defang its enemy, robbing it of its most potent weapons and forcing it to accept a ceasefire on Israel's terms. But Hezbollah is not giving up. It too has expanded its range of targets to include Haifa, Israel's big commercial port on the Mediterranean. A full-scale war is still not inevitable, but with no ceasefire in sight, it's hard to see either side backing down.
More than 20 flood warnings remain in place across central and southern England. The recent heavy downpours have left large craters on AFC Wimbledon's football pitch in South London. Photos show pools of water reminiscent of golf course bunkers or a building site where the grass would normally be. And the weather. Heavy rain will become lighter and patchier overnight. Tomorrow, sunny spells in many places. That's your BBC News. It's 3 minutes past seven.
Matt Shawley,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa Nadi, Central State of Culture Media as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley,
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live. This is 5 Live Sport.
The Monday Night Club with Mark Chapman.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Evening, welcome to 5 Live Sport this Monday evening. Monday Night Club on the way in just a second. BBC Sounds, the iPlayer, the website to listen or watch it. And then at 9 we'll do 5 Live Boxing with analysis of that remarkable fight on Saturday night with Daniel Dubois knocking out Anthony Joshua. Plenty of live football commentaries this week. EFL Cup over the next two nights. So Wickham Villa tomorrow night. Liverpool the holders against West Ham on Wednesday. Then as far as the Premier League is concerned at the weekend, we've got Arsenal Leicester at 3 on Saturday, followed by Wolves Liverpool. Newcastle City the 12:30. We'll have that as well. Sunday, Ipswich Villa and Manchester United Tottenham as part of Five Lives Premier League Sunday. Welcome to the Monday Night Club. Chris Sutton, Rory Smith and Andros Townsend are here. I'm going to have to start with Andros. You are still in Turkey and are you settled?
I'm in Turkey. I'm still trying to settle, but at least I'm in Turkey. I'm out of prison and I'm playing again.
Right, you are playing. We'll come more on to how it's going in Turkey. But I mean, on the basis that you're doing this, looking like you could be selling shots down the strip in Magaluf in just a vest, I'm guessing it's still very hot there.
It is, but yeah, I had some technical issues that obviously ideally I would have liked to change and be a bit more presentable, but I had some technical issues. So yeah, here I am.
Look, Andros, you're a professional footballer and you're ripped. You're allowed to do the show in the vest. You still look good. If I was doing the show in the vest, that's a different matter. And I would look, for older listeners, I would look like Jack Duckworth, I think, if I was doing it in a vest. But as you actually look like an athlete. So Andros and Rory and Chris are with us. We had an email into mnc@bbc.co.uk, and that's how you can get in touch this evening. You can text 85058. Our social media is at Five Live Sport. But Freddie said this, because Chris has had a truly remarkable week. He says, evening, folks, with the dust still settling on last week's revelations, surely a knighthood for Mr. Sutton is inevitable. On last Monday Night Club, he said he has done so much for Scottish football. Then on the Champions League highlight show on the Thursday evening, he said he was a better player than Zinedine Zidane. So this greatness must be honoured to its highest order. But would Chris accept any order bestowed upon him or politely decline with his usual grace? Would you accept a knighthood?
Absolutely. Of course I would. But I mean, you know, Mark, that I'm totally misquoted on both those fronts.
I was here for the first one. You're definitely not being misquoted.
No, you basically said you saved Scottish football last week. And then on Thursday, I said you're better than Zidane. And then what Freddie hasn't mentioned is that because it then got even better for Chris on Saturday night, 6:06. Have a listen to this.
I need to speak to Chris. I met him last week at Anfield and told him that it was my guilty pleasure, the man I'd most like to have a meal with in the evening. I just did a baby reindeer and stared at Chris all through the match.
If you two had a meal together, what do you think you would have?
Oh, I think a nice pasta dish.
Yeah, I can boil a kettle, do a bit of pasta, Debbie. That's easy. So, I mean, let's get it on then.
I mean, what a week you've had. Debbie's guilty pleasure.
I thought, because I met her at Anfield, and she said, "Give us a shout out." That was the previous week when they lost to Nottingham Forest, and I thought that had gone quiet. Ian Dennis knew about it,
right?
But he was the only one. So, I mean, who knows where that may end?
Well, with a pasta dish, I'm imagining Lady and the Tramp already, to be honest, when you share a bowl of spaghetti together. Right, let's get on, talk about the football then with Andros and with Chris and with Rory. Only one place to start, actually, obviously, Manchester City 2, Arsenal 2. So many stories, so many narratives from this game. I mean, we could do the whole 2 hours on it. If you had to pick one theme, one story, one narrative that you think is the most significant, what would it be, Andros?
Oof, so many to choose from. probably Arsenal's defending and the blueprint they've shown in the last two or three times they've faced Man City. They've shown how to really stop the unstoppable. So, yeah, for me, I'm taking away from that Arsenal's heroic defending with 11 men and also with 10 men.
Rory.
So I'd probably build on that a little bit and I'd say how much Arsenal have got under City's skin. I think what happened after the game, mainly centering on Erling Haaland, but with a little sort of dash of Bernardo Silva being a little bit salty in there as well, I think that indicates kind of how seriously City are taking Arsenal and the extent to which they see them as a genuine threat.
Chris?
Probably the gamesmanship and the time wasting towards the end of the game. And I mean, as an ex-player, I'm a massive hypocrite because I would have done exactly the same. But watching it on the television, I can imagine how the Manchester City players were completely rattled by that. They were brilliant at it. David Raya, every time he got the ball, 20 seconds at least, every time he got the ball. He had a marvellous game, but he was a master at just wasting time. And when it said 7 minutes at the end, I mean, I don't know how they came to 7 minutes. I know it was more than seven in the end, but it could have been 15 or 20 minutes, I'm sure, with the nature of their time wasting. They were brilliant at it.
Can I just say on the flip side, though, Chris, having played against Man City many times, they're also the masters of the dark arts. And if you've got a counter attack, they'll stop the counter attack. They pull you down. They'll take the yellow. So yeah, Man City are complaining on this occasion, but they're also guilty of being, guilty of the dark arts as well, should we say?
You would suggest, wouldn't you, Andros, that most successful teams are going to have an element of mastering the dark arts at some point, because you don't get to be a winner and be successful without having to adapt to certain circumstances, do you?
100%. And I've been in many dressing rooms where that Man City case has been brought up, and Liverpool, where it's been like, watch them, look how smart they are. They don't let counterattacks. They stop the foul. They stop it at the source. They don't concede goals on the counterattack. So yes, we marvel about how good they are going forward, but teams are also picking up and learning off how they manage games and how they stop counterattacks and stop the flow of the games also.
I don't know how new any of this is. I was trying to think, did Fergie's great Man United teams kind of commit what we now call tactical fouls? And for me, that's like a Fernandinho thing. He was the guy who...
Dark arts is more than tactical. I mean, you don't have to go all hipster on us. I mean, dark arts is more than tactical fouls, isn't it? It's getting under people's skin. It's you know, needle. It's frustration.
That has always existed. It's just that we now maybe call it the dark arts, whereas it is just I imagine that not having this game would have been on in Italy. They'll have watched it in Italy. There'll have been a lot of people kind of getting ready for the Milan derby and stuff, watching Man City Arsenal. I'm guessing the Italians were not thinking, oh, do you know what? Arsenal are really time wasting here. That is absolutely appalling. I think it's fairly standard, and it's just that there's a slight sort of sense that it's maybe not absolutely kind of straight up in that traditional English way. But I think, yeah, you can't be successful without doing it.
So we're copying the Italians, is what you're saying.
I'm unashamedly pro dark arts. That's what I'm saying.
Chris,
it's always been around. I mean, for God's sake, you don't have to be a winning team. I mean, you know, teams have time wasted since the year dot. That's the way it's been. You know, I think it was far worse, Rory, if you went back to my era. Sorry, Andros. But because I mean, the issue now is that there are cameras absolutely everywhere, so you can't really get away with everything as we did back in the day. But you know, holding from corners, stepping on people's toes. I mean, there were things going on in tunnels before the game. In my era, that, you know, I mean, that doesn't really happen anymore. But in
Kai Havertz took Rodri out inside.
He didn't.
Inside 20 seconds.
I mean, that was pathetic from Rodri, wasn't it? That was so pathetic from Rodri to go down for a couple of minutes. I mean, he barely touched him. That was ridiculous.
Oh dear. Yeah, but the point is, it's not just time wasted. It's not just a goalkeeper catching it and falling on the ball. My point was, even the great Barcelona team had Carlos Puyol, who might have been doing the odd thing at the back, or Real Madrid with Pepe, or I mean the Liverpool team, Rory, of the 70s and 80s, and I'm fairly sure the United team of the 90s and 2000s, and I just keep going through all the teams that won all the way. Leeds in the 70s, obviously, but
Sunderland's Bank of England team in the 1890s, famously. Rupert. No, I think the dark arts are separate to that kind of sort of 60s, 70s, bite your legs, Chopper Harris brutality. I think by dark arts, we mean the sort of snide ways that teams manage games. It's time wasting. It's the goalie falling on the ball and pulling the full Jan Oblak and not moving for 30 seconds. It's sitting down and saying you've got cramp when you don't have cramp. It's that stuff that seems to make fans a little bit more agitated than someone smashing into a two-footed challenge. I think it's because you feel as though it's, on some level, unsportsmanlike, and on some level, you are having entertainment removed from you, particularly with time wasting, that it feels like you've paid a lot of money for that ticket and or a lot of money for your TV package, and what you're getting to watch for that money is players trying to sit around and make stuff not happen. And I think that's why morally it's seen as being somehow worse than smashing into someone and trying to hurt them, which happened a lot more in Chris's era.
The problem is, Rory, I think all fans are happy for their own teams to do it if it means they win a football match. The only problem comes when the opposition do it. So, yeah, I'll take it all with a pinch of salt.
I actually take my hat off to him because was it Martinelli when he went? I mean, the Arsenal players were going down pretending they had cramp. Maybe they did have cramp, but they were like the little boys who cried wolf, really. And eventually, Michael Oliver had enough. But just with the time wasting thing, the onus really, Arsenal can do what they like if they can get away with it. The onus really is on the officials to add the time on, and that's why I was baffled about the 7 minutes thing at the end of the game. That was ridiculous. And the goalkeeper, there's this sort of general rule, isn't it? The 6 second rule. I think that's still in place. I mean, that was ridiculous. How long Raya was taking?
I think they've slightly changed that now. Do you know a bit more about the 6 second rule?
Somebody told me that they are trialling. Were you not in the office when somebody said this the other day, Chris? Was this not around the Champions League when we were sitting doing the Champions League highlights? No? No, obviously not. I think somebody, and when I say somebody who I think knows what they're talking about, said, Andros, that they're going to trial going to 8 seconds because they realise 6 seconds is not manageable, and 8 seconds, but they're going to be stricter on it. And if you go past the 8 seconds, the other team gets a corner. Is that what you've? Yes.
So I'm just checking my notes now from when the refs came into Luton in pre-season. It says, they're going to trial it in the reserves of the Premier League 2, I think it's called. And it's 8 seconds. And like you said, corner kick. So that is in fact correct.
Fair play for having your notes with you from when the officials came into Luton pre-season. Did they tell you anything else?
Oh, I've got a whole host of notes just waiting for the right moment.
It's interesting that Andros didn't take any long sleeve tops with him to Turkey, but he did take his notes from the meeting with the refs.
A final thing on the sort of time wasting and the delaying, and I think everybody nods at Andros's point that when your own team is doing it with the backs against the wall, everybody's like, oh, that's amazing. When it's happening against your team, you're like, God, this is disgraceful. And the neutral can get a little bit wound up by it. But Arsenal this season actually have the joint highest average restart time from dead ball situations, i.e. they're taking the longest to restart from dead ball situations, which is 33 and a half seconds. And they've had 198 sort of dead ball restarts. So that is quite a long time. The only thing that I would say, if you're going to sort of caveat that a bit, Rory, is that two of their Premier League games this season, they have been down to 10 men for the whole of the second half.
Yeah, and it's a really small sample size, so that's almost half. You know, two out of five games is a big old percentage that kind of influences the sample. The thing that I think is really interesting about Arsenal is there's a degree to which they are a much more, and I say this as a compliment, this is really meant as a compliment, they are quite a cynical team, and that is what you need to be successful. And I'm not sure that that's always picked up, really, because you think of Arteta as, obviously, he's very sophisticated, speaks multiple languages, Spanish, kind of that Guardiola training that he had as a coach. They've got lots of wonderful footballers, really attack-minded players. But they are a very controlled kind of... They're extremely good at shutting games down, as we saw yesterday, because for all the possession City had in that second half, there were an awful lot of shots from defenders. And I'm not Pep Guardiola, but I'm imagining that Pep Guardiola's plan for the second half was not, let's see if Ruben Diaz can score. It feels like maybe that was not something he wanted to happen. Arsenal shut that down absolutely brilliantly. We talked about Gabriel and Saliba last week as potentially the best central defensive partnership in Europe. But the whole team is very good at shutting space down, at basically stopping games happening if they need it to. And I'm not sure that that side of Arsenal is necessarily kind of appreciated as much as it should be.
How hard then on their defending? We'll come back to some of the, you know, housery aspects of this game in a little while and the rivalry that has now developed between these two. But on the defending, which you highlighted, Andros, as the biggest narrative to come out of yesterday, how hard is it to do what Arsenal did for the majority, you know, up until the 97th minute, for the majority of that second half?
Extremely, extremely tough, especially as, at least in the first half, when they suffered at times, they had the counter-attack, they had the outball, but in the second half, to literally have no counter-attacks whatsoever, to literally just kick it out for a throw or kick it up the pitch and wait for Man City to come again, it's extremely hard. So, no, listen, it was the impossible job in the second half, but they made it possible because of how they stuck together. They were 6-3 for most of the second half, 6-3-0. So no, it was incredible to witness. As somebody who's come through under Roy Hodgson, who prides himself on the sort of the shape side of it, it was beautiful to watch.
Is it harder mentally than physically, that?
Yes, but when you're winning, it's okay. Because you know the end goal. You know the end goal is the 3 points and getting to the end of the game, winning the game. So when you're winning, you don't mind doing whatever needs, even as a striker or a winger, you do whatever needs to be done for the 3 points. But the problem comes if Man City had scored earlier or when you're not winning.
I think it's really interesting that the way that he did set up second half Arteta, because most teams would set up with some sort of out ball. And he didn't, but that actually tells you the absolute confidence and belief that he has in his team defensively, that they could hold out as they did do, and actually just kept giving the ball back to Manchester City. I mean, when you actually think about that theoretically, how daft would that be for most teams to actually think that you're giving the ball back to the superior team in the land? I thought there was a fair bit of criticism OTT about Manchester City and the way that, you know, they moved the ball maybe not as quickly as they could have done. But I think Pep Guardiola said after the game, It's all right, going wide. And eventually the goal came from Grealish and maybe Arsenal switched off a little bit from his cutback. But you throw balls into the box and Arsenal defenders, they just deal with that anyway. So
even if you've got Haaland in there, though. Even if you've got Haaland
in
there. Yeah,
and that may, but they did do, didn't they, for, you know, the whole half of football. Whatever Manchester City threw at them, they dealt with. And I take your point about Haaland. He's a giant. But, you know, they were just trying to probe, keep probing and create an opportunity. And what Arteta and Arsenal were giving up, well, if somebody wants a pop from 25 yards, then we'll expect Raya to save that, or we'll take that. And that's what the concession was from Arsenal. And it very nearly worked.
But what was strange about that to me, just quickly, was what was really strange about that to me is that City are normally really good at not taking that invitation, at saying, we don't want the shot from 25 yards. We want to get it. We'll get it back. Fine, Gabriel, clear it all you like. We will get it back and we will keep on playing. But yesterday, there was a period for about, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 minutes, something like that, in the middle of the second half, where Diaz had a couple of goes, Vardy had a couple of goes. I think Akanji might have had a shot.
Walker had two.
Yeah, and then you kind of think, well, that's not very City. That suggests to me that City were, at the very least, getting frustrated with how much Arsenal, or how easily Arsenal, was shutting them down. Because ordinarily City would just get the ball back and play again and wait for the gap. That's Guardiola's whole thing.
I was just going to touch on your point. I was surprised at least the last 10, 15 minutes that, because Arsenal were allowing the three centre-halves to have the ball on the eight, just outside their 18-yard box, Walker, Akanji and Diaz, that Pep didn't just roll the dice and say, well, I'm going to put Kovacic in one of those positions or Foden in one of those positions and say, okay, if you want to give me time and space, I'm going to put players there that can thread a ball into the box or can shoot from 25 yards. But I'm not one to question the great Pep Guardiola, but yeah, surprised that didn't that wasn't their final sort of throw of the dice.
No, but the questions are, I mean, the questions are valid given how the patterns of play played out, aren't they, Andros? I mean, I know, I appreciate it's Pep Guardiola who is the manager of this team and everything he has achieved. But if you see the set, and you're not the only one, and several people pointed out, if that's the same pattern, it's coming back to your two centre-halves, and they're the ones that are striking it, or Kyle Walker, then do you need people in slightly different positions? It's a valid question.
Yeah, it is, but ultimately he made the changes which got them the goal. Jack Grealish was very direct and made the second goal. But yeah, I was looking at it thinking, Arsenal got no counter-attacking threat. They're just kicking the ball. You don't really need three defenders to worry about the counter-attacks. Can you sacrifice at least one and put a bit of quality in one of those positions to aid your attacks? But they got the goal in the end, and that was probably all that Pep wanted, to be honest.
But on Arsenal, given some of the football that they played last season, Chris, but how they've started this season, they only had 22% possession yesterday. In the second half, they just had 12.5%. Obviously, they were down to 10. Against Brighton, when they were down to 10, they only had 35.8% possession. Against Tottenham, 36.3% possession. Is it a change in how they're playing, or is it circumstances? They've had quite obviously quite a lot of big, difficult games early on.
Yeah, well, I think there is there is a tweak in the way that they're playing. Look, I think last season, if we remember their performance at the Etihad, and there was, you know, there was a viewpoint that Arsenal could have been braver, but we lavished praise on them last season for the way that they performed, and that was a rear guard action. I think the justification simply in situations like this is in the winning, and we'll simply find out at the end of the season. I thought that in the week against Atalanta in the Champions League, I thought they were so cautious. I thought that they, you know, we spoke about them being extremely direct, weren't brave enough to play out from the back. They didn't try short passes. They were actually braver at the Etihad than they were in Italy. My concern with Arsenal is looking at their bench in the week and looking at their bench to some extent yesterday, whether they actually do have the strength in depth within the squad, which City do have. They had a lot of young players on the bench against Atalanta, and that would be my concern. Of course, they're missing Odegaard, who is an enormous loss for them and their playmaker, and I wonder whether that sort of had an effect on them on Thursday night and certainly yesterday. But it's just about staying in touch with Manchester City, I think, for Arsenal at this moment in time, and they're doing it in a way which isn't overly attractive.
Chris, I just to touch on that, they've got injuries, but they've still got Gabriel Jesus, they've still got the Sterlings, they've still got Jorginho, they've still got Ben White, they've still got players, international players, who are good enough to be in the starting 11. Yes, they may not have the 25 that Man City have, all internationals, but they've still got five or six players who are good enough to be in that starting 11.
I think the loss of Odegaard is really significant, though, in terms of how they played, particularly against Atalanta. Obviously, what happened at the Etihad kind of turned on the Trossard sending off, although Trossard was only playing because Odegaard wasn't. But against Atalanta, they did seem to miss that kind of guile that he brings. He does kind of knit everything together. And I was speaking to my mate Max this morning, who's an Arsenal fan, who's in generally quite chirpy. And he so chirpy that he charged me 26p for a coffee rather than £2.60, which was a win for me. But his view was that...
Is it Max or Maximilian?
Max, this is Max, very much a Max, not a Maximilian. Might be short for Maximilian. But his view was that Odegaard's more important to Arsenal than Rodri is to City, and that maybe that might explain the fact that Arsenal do seem a little bit more cautious this season, is that without Odegaard, they lose a lot of their... They lose the guy who kind of, ties everything together.
But again, that's Atalanta away in the Champions League that we're looking at for evidence. Tottenham away in the Premier League, and Manchester City away. I mean, again, what it's Leicester, isn't it, at the weekend. Now, and it's also Bolton in the League Cup, but maybe you don't judge a lot by Bolton in the League Cup, depending on what teams put out. But Leicester, next weekend, then you might get a better idea of actually what they're like in an attacking sense without Ødegaard. No?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that you can't, certainly with City away, that's a special case, particularly in those circumstances. The majority of the Premier League is Leicester at home, and then they've got, is it Palace after that as well? I think they've got two home games before the international break. They're the games you have to, because of what City have kind of set down as the standard for winning the league, you can't drop points in those games. You have to kind of swat aside everybody apart from the top three or four. And that's how you win championships, is by winning those games. So if Arsenal can go and dispatch Leicester 3-0, then that's what they need to do. A point at the Etihad is a good result, even if in the circumstances it probably doesn't feel like it for Arsenal.
On the rivalry between the two, do we now have a sort of legendary rivalry bubbling, Chris? Because that's, and when I say that, I know Andros has just winced. When I say that, I don't necessarily mean always, you know, within a point of each other for the title, but two big clubs going for the title who don't like each other and have a real bit of needle between them.
Yeah, and that's what we want from two teams going head to head, isn't it? You know, we want that edge, that element of dislike, it does seem like that. In terms of a rivalry, Arsenal have to win something really for it to become a rivalry. As far as I could see, Manchester City have wiped the floor with
we sound like Bernardo Silva here.
Well, I'm trying not to, but you know, we can't call it a rivalry if Manchester City are cleaning up and winning everything. Arsenal have to make that next step, and maybe this season, maybe they're bullish and they feel that they can do that. But I just wonder, and I've been thinking about this a lot today when I was having a stroll with the dogs. If I was in the Arsenal dressing room at the end of the game, would that have felt like a defeat or an unbelievable point? I can't imagine what the dressing room would have been like, because on the face of things, at half time, I think that to end up drawing the game down to 10 men, you'd have thought, blimey, we'll take that. But the way it all panned out, I just wonder whether they would have felt so flat after that, and that would have felt, you know, like a defeat.
Your face implies, Andros, that you don't think it is a rivalry at the moment.
It's definitely a rivalry, but your words were legendary rivalry.
Sorry,
And I just echo what Chris says. To have a legendary rivalry, it needs to be Man City win it one year, then Arsenal, then Man City, then Arsenal. That's for it to be a real iconic rivalry. But it's definitely a rivalry, and it's one that the Premier League needs. Everyone's talking about now how football's not the same as it was before, and clashes like these and rivalries like this is exactly what we need to kind of get our football back.
Yeah,
you also need two petty managers who really don't like each other and who don't shake hands and embrace. You need a couple of shoves.
And we don't have that here, though, do we? They do like each other. That's the only annoying bit.
I don't know how the Italians would feel about that, Rory.
The Italians would regard it as being very, very important that managers are nice to each other. That one of the things they didn't like about Mourinho was when he randomly picked on the Lecce manager for some reason. I think he was struggling to find someone to have an argument with, so he picked on this otherwise sort of unremarkable manager of a small team. They thought it was terrible. They didn't shake his hand. They're very honourable Italian football managers.
To be honest, Antonio Conte is known for his honourable behaviour.
That's true, actually. Conte's the exception. Yeah.
Do you think we have a rivalry? Do we have two teams who needle each other?
The teams, yes. I mean, I agree with you. The manager's obviously very close. I don't know how that, like, friendship that they have survives if this will be the third year they've been head-to-head rivals for the title. I suspect that will put a friendship under pressure. But I thought
City-Liverpool didn't feel like they needled each other, did it? Fan bases needled each other, needle each other?
City-Liverpool was intense between the fan bases. I think the teams respected each other. But then listening to Bernardo Silva yesterday, it was, I'm sure he said something similar about Liverpool about 5 years ago. And I'm not convinced that Bernardo Silva thinks anyone can be Man City's rivals ultimately. But I thought I thought Haaland was interesting because, and I was thinking about this while I was walking my dog, Chris, that Haaland has a slightly, obviously he's an incredible player, that goes without saying, but he's got this kind of slightly kind of robotic reputation. You know, scores goals like a robot. He's not ever really struck me as being a kind of particularly arrogant, swaggering player. It's almost like he's a machine who goes onto the pitch, scores a load of goals, then leaves, powers down, someone oils him, and they wheel him out the next time. But to see him not just throwing the ball at Gabriel's head, which I thought was a really bad look, but then the exchange with Arteta, that's the first time I've ever seen kind of Erling Haaland peacocking. And it's not a great look, number one, but it does suggest to me that there is something going on there that suggests a genuine antipathy.
When you say throwing the ball at Gabriel's head is a really bad look, for who and in what? So, I mean, we all have a friend who's an Arsenal fan. So my friend Steve, who's an Arsenal fan, said to me, you know, having a slight joke at people laughing at Haaland hitting Gabriel on the head of the ball, he went, well, it's violent conduct. It's violent. Now, I don't know whether he's doing that partly tongue-in-cheek, but
I think why it's very is it a bad... It's very
it is
childish.
Very childish, yeah.
And I think I don't want to be like sound all prudish and like Mary Whitehouse, but I think it should probably be a booking.
So you're a referee now, aren't you?
I think we're all referees.
You did referee
Chris.
A game, didn't you?
That's the whole premise of this show.
Did you not referee a game for your son?
I did.
So what if that happened in a kid's game? Would you get the yellow card out?
I didn't have a yellow card. I thought no, I'd done well to remember to bring a whistle, but I would have had a strong word with the opposition coaches. Yeah, definitely. And if it had been my son, there'd have been no ice cream. But you know, you can't throw a ball at someone's head. No, that is. I was genuinely surprised today when the FA or PGMOL said they wouldn't take any further action. I think that is a bad look to me.
What would you charge him?
Yeah,
what would you charge him with, Rory?
Throwing a ball at someone's head. Bringing the game into disrepute. That's the catch-all for all that stuff, isn't it?
It's probably a yellow card if the ref sees it, but you can't charge him for just throwing a ball at somebody's head. Come on.
They should write that offence into the rule book for next season so that when the Turkish referees pitch up at Antalya Spor next season, there's a whole section on what happens if you throw the ball at someone's
head. I'm not condoning it, obviously. And what you don't want
it sounds
want
a bit
also,
like you think it's funny, so you think it should be allowed
well,
to
there is an element. The fact that Gabriel had his shirt over his head and then sort of had to pull the shirt off his head to see who did it, and Bernardo Silva was the closest to him, so immediately thought it was Bernardo Silva that had done it. There is an element. I mean, there is an element of farce about. You certainly don't want 9-year-old kids throwing balls at each other's head this week, and there will be people going, "Oh well, they copycat. They copy what the pros do." I do get that, but the fact that he had this shirt over his head and then was slightly bemused at who did it adds an element of farce to it, doesn't it, Chris?
I tend to agree with that. I thought it was humorous, and you know, Haaland was.
If it happened to you, if you were Gabriel, you'd want to thump him, wouldn't you? I mean, you would.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
there was the needle at the end of the game. I actually quite like it when you see the Haaland at the end of the game and the humble stuff to Mikel Arteta. I like that. That's authenticity. That's the way, you know, both sets of players are feeling. And, you know, that came across through the television screens. And that's what we want to watch. You know, it's a fixture now where the next fixture between these two sides, everybody's going to be watching the tunnel. Every match.
Well, I was going to say, you'll want the camera in the tunnel pre-match at the Emirates. And that's, I suppose, a final thing on this, Andros, which is, these kind of things happen more in Chris's day, most definitely. But do you think now, even in this era, that there will be genuine needle that's carried over, that you know, for all everything is planned and data and analytics or whatever, there is still some raw emotion here. And in the build-up to the next Arsenal City game, it will be, don't forget, Haaland threw the ball at your head after they equalised on Sunday.
Yeah, 100%. Mm. And I remember the Battle of the Bridge, Spurs against Chelsea. That sort of carried over for the next two or three years. So there's definitely going to be some carryover into the next time they play.
MNC at bbc.co.uk if you want to get in touch with us, 85058 at 5 Live Sport. Still waiting for news on Rodri's injury as well. Just a very quick one on that. If that, Chris, does show that he's out for a while, is that, I mean, obviously that's a big blow. Can Kovacic fill that role? Because he did at the start of the season, didn't he?
Yeah, look, I don't think anybody can fill that role like Rodri, but I think Kovacic is as able a replacement out there. But I think Manchester City, we've seen in the past, they'll find a way of coping. They always do.
Has that not been confirmed, ACL?
I don't think it's been confirmed yet. I've just got a possible serious knee injury, but it hasn't been confirmed.
I think The Athletic and ESPN and Marca are all saying it's an ACL, but I don't know whether... But they're also all saying there's further tests to be done, so I think until those tests have been done, we can't be certain it's an ACL, but it sounds like it's relatively serious.
Yeah, the way he pulled up and grabbed his knee and was writhing around in pain, I'd be pleasantly surprised, but I'd be very surprised if it was anything other than the ACL.
Thank you very much. Go on, what?
I was going to say that I think the key thing with that is that he is obviously incredibly important to City. There is this ridiculous stat that they haven't lost a game since the foundation of like money as a concept since he was playing, but
the cup final,
which it's a very small percentage of the population, not very small, but it's a specific proportion of the population that insist on saying, oh, remember the cup final? They haven't lost a league game for about a year with Rodri playing.
Are you ignoring the FA? Does the FA Cup final not count?
It's more of a friendly.
That was a bad stat, wasn't it?
The thing is, in the run of normal fixtures, City will be fine. Where it makes a difference is if Rodri's out for a long period of time and you have to play a Champions League semi-final without Rodri. That's when it becomes an issue. But for the vast majority of Premier League games, Croatian international with, 70, 80 caps, Mateo Kovacic, formerly of Real Madrid and Chelsea, he can probably fill in.
Nick on the email, watching on the iPlayer, regular viewers of Monday Night Club may be worried that Rory's house has subsided. I think his camera's just wonky, to be honest with you. I don't think he's... although he looks slightly concerned.
I'm a bit worried now. Yeah, I don't think so. And
thank you to the anonymous text. All Monday Night Club listeners wish Debbie a full and speedy recovery. Six teams are winless, five games into the season for the first time in English top flight history. So in large part, that's down to Southampton and Ipswich and Leicester and Everton both ending in draws at the weekend. And we'll come on to the newly promoted sides shortly and what it's like after five or six games of the season. But first we're going to talk about the team who are bottom of the Premier League, and that is Wolves. They have just one win across their past 15 Premier League games, including 11 defeats. They've taken 6 points from their last 45 available. The only team they've beaten over that period are now in the Championship. They've kept one clean sheet since the 22nd of January in the league, which was also against a different current Championship team. So when you look at all of those stats, they sound terrible. But my theory, or not my theory, but my feeling, Dave Azzopardi from the Talking Wolves podcast, as we bring you in, is that I really enjoy watching you. You don't strike me as a terrible team.
We're not. We actually play, and we've seen it already this season, we actually play some half-decent stuff. And I know the stats that you've just read out there don't sound too promising and are completely against Wolves. But I think if you actually look at those on paper, you've played Arsenal, Liverpool, City a number of times, Chelsea. So those fixtures are tough games. And we do sit, obviously, at the bottom of the Premier League still. Our start to the season has been tough, and it won't get any easier because we've got Liverpool and City in Annex 3. But it's one of those at the moment. It's sort of very down in amongst the Wolves fan base. I think a lot of people are using those stats from last season, carrying on into this campaign. And yeah, I think there is a little bit of pressure starting on Gary O'Neill now. I like what he's trying to do. We are playing some half-decent stuff, but ultimately it's a results business and we're not getting those results.
So what are the fans down on? The end results, presumably. Because as I say, you score great goals, you play some really good football. I mean, and all teams at the bottom could say this. There are just endless ways. You've been a bit unlucky there, or you've been a bit unlucky there. Like you were, for the first half against Villa, you were good. A lot of the game against Newcastle, you were good, and then they pull out a worldie to two worldies, really, to win it. It's odd. That's all I'm saying.
There's like really fine margins at the moment. You've mentioned the two there, Newcastle and Villa. We were fantastic against Villa, but then in the first half, then the second half, it was a completely different side. And I think a lot of people are pointing that finger at Gary O'Neill for how he set us up in the second half. The end of the first half, we were knocking the ball around in Villa's half. They had 11 men behind the ball and they were 1-0 down. Second half, completely different story where we had 11 men behind the ball. But a lot of players on bookings, just daft, silly bookings early on in the game, which sort of cost us, as you know, like later on in the game, you want to take a tactical foul. We weren't really able to do that. And ultimately, a little bit of luck for Villa's first goal. But after that, there was only one winner, really. Even the Chelsea game earlier on, I know, again, smashed us 6-2. But by half time, we had all the momentum. It was 2-2 and completely threw it away. So I don't know. I think it's one of those things when you're in a football match and you're feeling confident and you're feeling high because you won the up and then you throw it away and lose the game. Ultimately, there's only one thing people tend to blame, and unfortunately, it's the manager.
Is there at least a little bit of kind of understanding, though, that he lost Kilman and Pedro Neto in the summer, and it seemed that like replacing them was not rushed, but that it didn't seem like Wolves we're kind of executing a long thought out strategy. It was like, okay, they've gone now. We've got to do this, this and this. And it felt a bit like the squad came together quite late in the window.
Yeah, it was a strange one because I think long term, they felt Mosquera was the Kilman replacement. Although when you sell somebody for 40 to 45 million, as outsiders and even as fans, you expect that to be invested straight back into that same position, and it wasn't. Neto was one as well where I don't think you were ever able to get a like-for-like replacement as good as Pedro Neto, but there wasn't really a plan with that either. So I think that is a concern. I think fans still wanted another centre-back in, and that's become a bit of an issue now. Mosquera's come off against Villa with a serious injury. A lot of fans saying, can we go back to a back five? Because that seems to always solidify us, get some positive results and go from there. We can't really do that because of the fitness and the availability of that position. So very strange times, really strange times at the club at the moment on that front as well.
You spoke about there being a bit of unrest towards Gary O'Neill, which surely you look at the fixture list and you say, at least let's wait until November. We've got a clear run of fixtures where we should pick up a large amount of points, and then we can judge Gary O'Neill, and then we can judge our season and how the team's progressing.
Yeah, that's what I mean. We had a good discussion earlier on our podcast about it, and sort of there was three of us on there, two of them leaning towards moving the manager on already, and that's the point I made, Andros. I said, you look at our fixtures between now and the end of October, they're tough. Like I said earlier, we've got Liverpool, we've got City, still got to play Brighton away. And then the start in between November and Christmas, no disrespect to these teams, but we're playing the newly promoted guys. We've got, I think, Southampton and somebody else back-to-back at home in the first two games in November.
Palace.
So I think those two games are definitely games you can get points from. It's just can we keep our heads above the water? Can we keep ourselves, if we are going to be in the bottom three at that point, is it only going to be 3 or 6 points?
Well, Bournemouth had to wait 9 games last year, didn't they? Yeah. Bournemouth had a terrible start.
Well, didn't they?
Yeah.
And playing good football as well. And I think that's a similar position to Wolves. I think Brentford's a big one in 2 weeks. I think everyone's almost writing off the Liverpool game next week, but Brentford away, I think if he loses that, there's going to be serious pressure on him. But ultimately, it depends on what the club and him have discussed. I think the club should be clever enough. They've given him a 4-year contract in the summer, just gone. They're going to know that fixture list is tough. So if you know, hopefully they've sat down with him and said, look, we understand the situation. I think what upsets a lot of fans is he's got quite almost a defeatist attitude towards things sometimes, Gary. Whereas we look back at the times under Nuno, for argument's sake, and we went into every single game knowing we could win, or Nuno would have a positive outlook on things. Whereas Gary is very quick to blame things sometimes in his post-match press conferences. But I really hope he can turn it around, because like you said, Mark, I think we play some good football. We've got a really good squad of players, certainly a talented squad that shouldn't be in and amongst this battle down at the bottom. Well, but things need to change.
I know there's always kind of disappointment at who leaves, and it takes time for players to then settle in when they're brought in to replace them. And I take Rory's point when you're looking at centre-halves and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But you have brought in so many players that other clubs will sniff around and take. You know, if you were to go down, for example, and there had to be a fire sale, there would be a lot of players that clubs in the Premier League would look at. So you look at that. I mean, you know, Andre, who you brought in this summer in midfield, there were loads of Premier League clubs that were looking at him.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent. I mean, there's so many players. Andre's been quite good the last couple of weeks. Since he's come into the team, he's been one of the better players. But you're right. I mean, Mateus Cunha, you know, every single position we've got a top player. I mean, Cunha, Lamina, João Gomes, Andre, all in midfield are very good. It's just, I don't know. We have some really, really solid moments, really good moments. And I think it's being a bit more ruthless in front of goal. Again, against Villa, we had chances to go 2-3 goals up. The Chelsea game, just daft mistakes. Newcastle game, it's that sort of bad luck against us. There's genuinely a game where it could all just fall into place, a click, and we're like, what were we worried about? But
it's very unfair the way people spin stats and look back to last season, because as a whole, what Gary O'Neill did, what he took over, I think there were more points last season than the previous season. You know, he did an incredible job. So, I mean, we're in a day and age where, you know, everything is so short-termist in football, but it seems to me at this moment in time, you're talking about difficult fixtures coming up, but Wolves fans need to keep the heads, because this is all going to end in an ugly way and probably an unfair way if you're talking about now a fair few fans turning against him. That atmosphere within the stadium or at away games isn't going to be helpful for anybody, is it?
No, definitely. I think, unfortunately, and I think every football club has it, Wolves fan base, and I can, you know, I'm in that fan base, we are very fickle almost. And I think we were very spoilt by when we first came back into the Premier League, because under Nuno, there were almost three immaculate seasons where he won us the Championship, got us into seventh, and we finished seventh again with Europa League football. And the season after, we sort of went down to 14th, and everyone was going 12th or 14th, and everyone was going ballistic. It was like, why haven't we finished seventh again? And sort of that sort of carried over. And I think every time Wolves go on this little bad run, it's like, no, it's not good enough. We should be in the top half. We should be competing for Europe. And unfortunately, unless we are, and you know, the ownership have changed how they want to work the club, but unless you are spending millions and being right on the edge of PSR, which Wolves have had to do when they were in trouble before, you're not going to be able to do that. So, it's frustrating, but no, I do agree. But I said, I think if you get into October and you're still winless, I think that's when it's going to become toxic and quite uncomfortable, I think, at times at Molineux.
Dave, thank you very much for coming on. Dave Azzopardi from the Talking Wolves podcast with us on the Monday Night Club. As far as the three promoted sides are concerned at the moment, and we'll start with you, Andros, from last season's memories with Luton. The three promoted sides between them have got 7 points so far. Leicester and Ipswich have drawn 3 of their 5, and Southampton have drawn 1 of their 5. Only 5 games in. When do you start to get concerned?
I don't think at the moment, because especially watching the Ipswich and Southampton game, both teams have got a clear identity in how they want to play. And I think if you go back to Luton last season, we didn't get that until maybe end of October, early November. So I think they're already ahead of where we were. Southampton, obviously, is just cutting out the silly mistakes. They're playing out from the back and they're losing it and conceding goals. But I don't think they should just throw everything out that they learned from the Championship. I think they should continue doing it and improve, and those players will improve with it, which they'll get confident. They've come up from the majority of that group have come up from League One into the Championship, into the Premier League. So there's always going to be a bit of adaptation, and I can see they're improving every game. So I think, yeah, it's still too early to really see which teams are going to be in big trouble this season.
The importance is, I think, is for the teams who come up, as well as Ipswich have done, because they've had, I mean, the fixtures were so unkind to them, the first two games, Liverpool and then Manchester City, but they've stayed in the last three games. They've got draws, and I suppose that will give them an element of confidence. But I always think for promoted sides, you need that first win under the belt to then have that real belief in the way that you play. And I think at the weekend, I worry about Southampton, because I thought they just about deserved to win the game at the weekend. And then that went against them, and they've been, the late goal, from Morsi. There's been a lot of criticism about Southampton playing out from the back, but I'm sort of with Andros. You have your principles of play, and you have to believe in those principles. But the way they play, it is adventurous. We have seen teams come up in the past and play that way and then lose confidence. So I think that was a really sore one for Southampton, especially at the weekend, that they just didn't get over the line to really have that belief where that's our first win and we can kick on.
How, I always think with Southampton, Andros, everybody needs this, obviously, so Chris will laugh at this comment. They need someone to put the ball in the back of the net. They average 580 passes per game as a team. Only City have a higher average of Premier League teams. They average 60% possession so far. Only City, Tottenham and Brighton have more. They're averaging 12 shots a game. But when you come from the Championship to the Premier League, you need one of your strikers, equally if they're a new signing, to get off the mark. And maybe you saw it, I don't know, someone like Carlton Morris last season, who once he got his first one, then had a little bit more confidence about being in the Premier League, and they haven't had that yet.
I would probably use the other striker, Adebayo. He was somebody who had a good reputation from the Championship, came up to the Premier League, didn't score for the first five or six games, lost his place in the team. But once he did get that first goal, when he got his place back into the team, he was unstoppable. And if it wasn't for injury, he definitely would have got at least 15 Premier League goals. So yeah, I think Southampton need that sort of striker to, once they get a goal, to really go on a run and make them put away the chances that they are creating, because they are a very good side. With Adam Lallana now in the midfield, they are more comfortable in getting playing out from the back. But yeah, they do need that number nine and somebody who's going to score 10 to 15 goals this season.
Cameron Archer missed the penalty, didn't he, against Manchester United? You felt that was a huge moment in Southampton's season. I know they ended up losing quite comfortably in the end, but the chance to take the lead, and you're right, a striker who's gone there really needs to prove himself at Premier League level. That wouldn't have done him a lot of good. I saw the first game of the season against Newcastle. Newcastle had a player sent off, I think it was Fabian Schär, really early on in the game. And they were not creative enough and ruthless enough in the final third. I think we all think that Brereton Diaz can nick a goal, but can he nick it at the top level? It's interesting, you know, at the weekend, they certainly, you look at their bench and think, blimey, you know, Adam Armstrong on the bench, Cornet on the bench, Aribo, Brereton Diaz, Kyle Walker-Peters. That's not a bad bench, but, you know, they actually need sort of a result, the team to really force a win, however they're going to do it.
Well, Rory wrote the book on this. I mean, their goals are averaging 0.4 goals per game. Their expected goals is 1.42. If you look at one of the other promoted sides, if they had Jamie Vardy, would they be in a slightly different position, Southampton?
Quite possibly, yeah. I suppose it depends how it fits into the system. The one thing that struck me about Archer is that he's missing chances. And the penalty aside, penalty is obviously slightly different, but he's really lively, he works really hard, and he's getting into the positions that he needs to get in, into for to convert those chances, because Southampton do create chances. And if I was Russell Martin, which I'm not, that I would look at that as a sign of encouragement that you are at least you're making those opportunities in the Premier League against the better quality of opposition. And Cameron Archer, it may well be that he gets one or two and then suddenly the kind of the confidence comes. I suppose if it doesn't, then maybe in January you look at it and think, right, we need someone, it won't be Jamie Vardy, but someone like that, maybe more experienced, who has just got that.
Who's going to want to go there in January? Who's going to want to go there in January if the team are toiling?
I don't want to make it sound like footballers are mercenaries, Chris, but someone who likes the money they're offering, I would imagine. You know, if it's a chance to be a Premier League striker for 6 months, why would you not go?
But the point being is there will be better clubs out there for anybody who's any good, with the greatest respect.
Are there more? That's an interesting question. You know, are there more clubs than there are players who would like to play for? No, I think there's probably an endless supply of footballers. I think Southampton could probably. The problem with strikers is they cost money. They cost a lot of money. But by January, you might find that someone out of favour a little bit further up the league. Mm. There might be a player who's doing well in the Championship. Well, I don't know who'll be out of favour at other Premier League teams in January. I'm not a clairvoyant. I'm just saying that it's entirely possible that you might have a player who is available to Southampton in January who maybe would not have been available to them in the summer. Mm.
That was a striker just FaceTiming Rory to say, could you let Southampton know that I might be available?
Everything's on Do Not Disturb. I'm not quite sure who that was. Very interesting. I do apologise.
Do you, when you look at Ipswich, who obviously had Liverpool and City first, but they picked up points, as Chris said, Andros, in their last three games. Now, they averaged the least possession at the moment in the Premier League so far this season. Do you sort of applaud them for actually being quite pragmatic so far in their start to the Premier League season?
I think they've been pragmatic in terms of keeping possession and how much possession they've had, but out of possession, they're quite aggressive in the way they like to press. They like to commit men forward. So yeah, I applaud them for coming up from the Championship and being fearless in, like I said, out of possession, the way they commit men forward. Even in possession, they may not have possession, but when they do, they get a lot of bodies on the final third. And I'll go back to Luton last season. We didn't have that belief for a good few months, and Ipswich are so far ahead of where we were last season because they have come up with that no fear. They've stuck to their beliefs, and it's only a matter of time before those players, a lot of those haven't played Premier League football before they get the confidence. They have that feeling of, right, we are good enough. These superior players we've watched on TV, they are only players and we are good enough to be here. And I'm sure you'll see the possession gradually get more and more as the season goes on.
And just a quick one on Leicester before we go to the news, and then Ian Graham is going to join us. He played such a crucial part in Liverpool's transfer policy over many, many years, and he's got a book out. It's all to do with data revolution, so we'll talk to him about that. He's joining us live in just a moment. Just on Leicester, Chris, do you think their greatest, I don't know,